So in chapter 4 of the book of Jonah, the prophet is angry that God has spared Nineveh, that he has showed Nineveh mercy and he has not destroyed it. And he cries out to God and he says, O Lord, is this not what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. And the Lord said, Do you do well to be angry? And you might remember from that sermon back in June that Jonah doesn't answer God. He doesn't answer God's question. The text goes right on. Jonah went out of the city and sat to the east of the city and made a booth for himself there. He sat under it in the shade till he should see what would become of the city. So Jonah complains to God, but he doesn't want to engage God. And he turns away when God speaks. He goes out and he builds a booth. Habakkuk, the prophet, also cries out to God. We saw this last week at the beginning of chapter 1. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. So like Jonah, Habakkuk has a complaint, and he complains to God. But when we last left Habakkuk, at the beginning of chapter 2, he had said this, I will take my stand at the watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me. What I will answer concerning my complaint. So Jonah ignores God, goes out and builds a booth for himself, and hopes to see Nineveh go up in smoke. But Habakkuk goes to his watchpost, which is kind of like going and building a booth. He goes to his watchpost to see what God will say to him. And he's going to station himself on the tower, meaning he is not going to budge until God answers for himself. And once Habakkuk sees what God says to him, then he will know how to respond. So in his booth, Jonah does not want to engage God, and he waits in anger. But in his watchpost, Habakkuk wants to engage God, and he's waiting in faith. And that's where we're picking things up tonight. So if you haven't already turned to Habakkuk chapter 2, go ahead and turn there. And we'll start at verse 2. Habakkuk 2:2 and following. So these verses, we hear God's response to Habakkuk's lament in chapter 1. If you remember, all of chapter 1 is a lament from Habakkuk, and now God responds to him beginning in verse 2. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. So God tells Habakkuk to write the vision. Remember that Habakkuk said that he would see what God had to say to him. Well, now he's literally going to see what God says to him because God says to write the vision down. Write the vision, make it plain on tablets. And we'll see what this vision is in verses 6 through 20. But first, God says in verse 4, behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Now, it's easy to go on to the second part of that verse, the righteous shall live by his faith. That's a very famous verse in Scripture. Paul uses it in Romans 1. But we don't want to blip by the first part of verse 4, where it says his soul is puffed up within him. Whose soul is puffed up? There doesn't seem to be a reference for the his there in the verse. But I think the picture becomes clearer as we go on to the next verses. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So whose soul is puffed up? It's the one who collects for himself all peoples. And surely that's King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Because in Habakkuk's lament, in chapter 1, he had cried out, "You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. So he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever?" So Nebuchadnezzar is the one whose soul is puffed up. And why not? Frankly, he's marching all across the known world and collecting the nations, and nothing can stop him. And that's what Habakkuk is lamenting to God. But the vision that Habakkuk is going to write down, which is in verses 6 through 20, is the demise of the Babylonians. That's the vision that God is having him write down, that one day the Babylonians will get their due. So your little headline before verse 6 probably says something like, "Woe to the Chaldeans." Now, last week, I corrected that as a mistake in chapter 1. I'm not going to do that this time. This is a woe to the Chaldeans. What follows is five woes, five instances of the Babylonians' crimes and the punishment that's going to come. And I'm not going to read through those verses. We're not going to look at it tonight. But the most important thing is that God knows what the Babylonians are doing, and he promises that they won't get away with it. He is going to see to it that they are punished for their crimes. It's the same old story, really. Empires come and go. They conquer and they expand their territory, and then somebody bigger than them comes along and supplants them. And Judah's hope can't be that they will be big enough so that God will put them back on the top of the hill and they'll get to be king of the hill again. That can't be the vision that they have. Rather, God gives Habakkuk a better vision. This is in verse 14. "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." And in verse 20, "The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him." God says, "Don't worry, Habakkuk. The Babylonians will get their due. I'll see to that. They will not endlessly fill their nets with the nations of the earth. I will judge them and I will execute my wrath upon them, and their violence and their injustice will be returned on their own heads." That's the content of the vision that God tells Habakkuk to write down in verse 2. So in verses 2 and 3, we get the command for Habakkuk to write the vision. And in verses 6 through 20, it's the content of the vision itself, that the Babylonians will one day face the wrath of God. But why does God tell Habakkuk to write down the vision in verse 3? Well, we get a hint of it. So we look at verse 3. "For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay." The vision of the Babylonians' defeat is in the future, and it will seem slow. It will seem delayed. It will seem like it's never going to come. And here's the sad truth for Habakkuk. He's probably not going to live long enough to see this vision come to fruition. He needs to write down the vision for future generations, because he's probably going to be dead when the Babylonians go down. When Habakkuk dies, the Babylonians will still be on top. But the written vision will stand as a promise of what is to come. And although it may seem like it's never going to happen, God says it's hastening toward the present. It's speeding toward the present. It's moving forward at a great rate of speed. It will surely come. It will not delay. So we have three things that we want to keep in mind here. First, we have the dominant strength of the Babylonian Empire in the present. And then we have God's promise that that power will come to an end in the future. And then we have all the time in between the present and the future. And Habakkuk will call this period of time in chapter 3, in the midst of the years. He will refer to it as in the midst of the years. So how is one to live in the midst of the years? How are we to live between the present that we experience and God's glorious promises for the future? How do we live in that space? Well, God tells us in verse 4. Again, probably one of the most well-known verses in the Old Testament. The righteous shall live by his faith. That's how we live in the midst of the years. That's God's answer for how to live in troubled times. But there's a lot to unpack in that little verse, that little half verse of 4. First of all, faith is better translated as faithfulness. The one who is righteous shall live by his faithfulness. When we think of faith, we often think of what we believe. We think of the content of what we believe to be true. But that's not what God actually has in mind here. What God has in mind is how the righteous person lives, how the righteous person lives before God, and that's characterized by faithfulness. Faithfulness is devotion and loyalty to another. So the righteous person shall live by his faithfulness and his devotion to his God. Now, here's where things get just a little bit technical and tricky for us. And I'm going to try to not overcomplicate things, but if I'm going to lose you at any point, it's in the next 5 minutes. So if you could just dig right in with your attention, I'll try to not make things overly confusing. But the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew, and it was later translated into Greek. And sometimes that creates translation challenges for us. The Hebrew for this verse is what gives us the translation of "the righteous shall live by his faithfulness." But the Greek translation for the Hebrew says this: "the righteous shall live by my faithfulness." The righteous shall live by my faithfulness. And remember that it's God speaking here to Habakkuk. And he's saying that the righteous person will live by his proven faithfulness. God's past faithfulness guarantees his future faithfulness, namely his fulfillment of the vision that one day the Babylonians would be defeated, the very vision that he told Habakkuk to write down. So one version says that the righteous person will live by his faithfulness to God. The other says the righteous person will live by God's proven faithfulness. So which is correct? Well, here's the beautiful thing. We don't have to choose one or the other because both are true and both are essential. Both are true and both are essential. The righteous person lives by their faithfulness to God's faithfulness. The righteous person lives by their faithfulness to God's faithfulness. God's promise to take our broken world and to make it right, to put things right again. And he sent Jesus, in whom he is reconciling all things on heaven and earth, in heaven and on earth, as it says in Colossians 1:20. And when we consider Jesus' life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension, we see that the Father's faithfulness to us is unquestionable. His faithfulness to us is unquestionable. If we don't believe that God will be faithful to enact his promises, we will not be able to live. We won't be able to live. We may give the appearance of being alive, but inside we will be spiritually dead. Even worse, God says we will be puffed up. Remember the first part of 2:4. Behold, his soul is puffed up within him. When we're puffed up, we think that we know better than God. We think that we see more than God does. We try to secure our own well-being, and we reduce the world to what we can see because we will not be fooled and we will not be taken in. At the end of Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia in the last battle, the main characters have died and they find themselves in Aslan's glorious country, and everything is stunningly beautiful and there is amazing food for them all to eat. But in their group, there's a group of dwarves who were not faithful to Aslan in the last battle. And it's because they didn't believe in Aslan. So where everybody else is enjoying Aslan's country and all there is, the dwarves believe that they are in a dark, crummy hovel, a confined space just eating rotten vegetables and dirt. And everybody who's trying to tell them, no, you're really in this glorious country and the food is really good, they will not believe them because the dwarves will not be taken in like that. They know better. The dwarves are for the dwarves, they say. And distraught, Lucy asks Aslan if there is anything that he can do for these unhappy creatures. And Aslan says, they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their minds, yet they are in that prison. And so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. That's the soul that is puffed up. If you will not trust God to fulfill his promises, it's a prison of your own making, but you're very much in that prison. The righteous person lives faithfully by God's proven faithfulness. And I want to be clear about something too. I'm not talking about non-Christians on the one hand and Christians on the other. And neither is God here in Habakkuk. He's talking about people who claim to be in the family of God and yet who think they know better and try to secure their own lives. The Old Testament's full of examples. Despite God's deliverance from Egypt at the Red Sea, we get Israel accusing God of bringing them out into the wilderness just to kill them and leave them there, and complaining about the manna that he gives them, and refusing to go into the promised land once they hear the spies report. Despite God's faithfulness again and again and again, Israel refused to be taken in, and so they were taken out. And the same thing can happen to us. We can hear God's promises and think, yeah, but there's this, or there's this. And just because we've been baptized in the name of Jesus doesn't mean that we don't sometimes get puffed up and think that we know better than God and try to take matters into our own hands. So what does living by faithfulness to God's faithfulness look like? Well, we certainly see it in Jesus. He's the ultimate example of this verse in the flesh. Jesus trusted his Father through every trial. For the joy set before him, he suffered the cross. And although the world condemned him, he trusted that his Father would vindicate him, and he did. Trust, obedience, and vindication. That's what we're called to in this in-between time in the fulfillment of God's promises. That's what we're called to in the midst of the years. This is God's answer to Habakkuk's lament in chapter 1. God says to Habakkuk, I am going to take care of business. Trust me. Trust me. And so in chapter 3, Habakkuk responds to God. Remember, he said he would wait and see what God had to say to him, and then he would know how to respond. Well, in chapter 3, we get Habakkuk's response. And he responds with a psalm. But it's not a psalm of lament like in chapter 1. This is a different kind of psalm. Habakkuk says in verse 2, O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. What's the report that Habakkuk has heard? The report that he's heard is of the great deeds of the Lord in Israel's history. In the song that we sang a little bit ago, based on this verse, the line is, Lord, I have heard of your fame, and I stand in awe of your deeds. Those deeds, those great acts of the Lord, are the basis for his faithfulness. He's proven himself to be faithful. The righteous shall live by God's faithfulness, and he's established his faithfulness through faithful deeds. You see, our devotion to God isn't based on philosophy or theology. It's based and rooted in history. It's based in God's great saving acts in time. Paul says in Romans 5:6, for while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. In Galatians 4:4, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. God's acted in time by sending his Son to restore man to himself. And we're called to respond in time. We're called to respond in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years is a time of waiting. It's a time when not a whole lot seems to be going on. It's a wilderness time. It can be a time when God seems absent, not very close. It can be a time of barrenness and hopelessness. And it's during this time that the righteous faithfully live by God's faithfulness. We can decide now how we will live in the midst of the years, in the meantime, in the day to day. We can look out at a broken world and remember God's past works of faithfulness and stand confident that his good purposes will come to pass. And that's exactly what Habakkuk does in the rest of this psalm. Beginning in verse 3, Habakkuk recalls God's great acts in Israel's history. Here's just one example in verse 11. The sun and moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. That recalls one of Israel's victories where God made the sun stand still in its place for a whole day in Joshua 10 so that God could defeat their enemies for them. Habakkuk's psalm portrays God as a mighty warrior who has fought for Israel in the past. But Habakkuk isn't only remembering things. He's also anticipating. He's anticipating what God is going to do in the future. What God has done before, he's going to do it again. And when he's finished, Habakkuk says in verse 16, I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us, referring to the Babylonians. Habakkuk will quietly wait for the day that God will visit his wrath upon the Babylonians, even though he probably won't live to see that day. And he talks about rottenness entering into his bones and his legs trembling, and we might think that Habakkuk is merely resolved to just endure a terrible situation, to just grit his teeth with a grim determination and get through to the end. But that's not the way the psalm concludes. And in verses 17 through 19, once again, these prophets end on a note of hope. Habakkuk says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Habakkuk is living in hard days, and he knows it, and there will be more hard days to come. There won't be fruit on the vine. And because Israel is often symbolized by the fig tree, he's saying that there won't be fruitfulness in exile. Israel will lack every good thing that would seem to point to God's blessing upon Israel. And yet Habakkuk will rejoice in the Lord his God. He will take joy in the God of his salvation. He will make God his strength, not the easy flow of good circumstances. To rest on God kicking out the Babylonians would just be to rest on circumstances that can change. His joy and his strength will rest in God himself, who will carry Habakkuk and Judah through all the trials to come. Habakkuk is the righteous person of 2:4. When God says the righteous person will live by his faithfulness, in God's faithfulness, that's Habakkuk. And we see the evidence in this psalm that he's given us. Through the psalm, he's faithfully living by God's faithfulness. He recalls all that God has done to show that he is faithful. And then Habakkuk says, I'm throwing in my lot with you. My joy and my strength are with you, God. He will be faithful to his God regardless of what happens. I think of the last lines of Be Thou My Vision. Heart of my own heart, whatever befall, still be my vision, O ruler of all. Whatever befall, That could be a lot of things. It could be a lot of bad things. But God makes our feet like the deer's, able to keep our footing in dangerous and treacherous places. So a few thoughts for application as we wrap up Habakkuk. As I said last week in Habakkuk's complaint, he has two questions for God. Why is this happening? And how long? When is it going to end? And we see that God doesn't answer Habakkuk's why or how long questions. But he calls us to remember his faithfulness and to let that be our guide, his faithfulness. That's what it looks like to faithfully live in the midst of the years. And as this book ends, Habakkuk's circumstances are no different than they were at the beginning of the book. As he finishes that psalm, in chapter 3, he's in no different of a position than he was at the beginning of chapter 1. But Habakkuk himself has changed. In chapter 1, Habakkuk lamented, but in chapter 3, he makes the turn to rejoicing in lament. Remember, I mentioned a book last week by a guy named Todd Billings, who was diagnosed with an incurable cancer at age 39, the book called Rejoicing in Lament. And Billings says that a lot of Christians make the mistake of believing that as long as they are, quote unquote, good Christians, that God will not let anything seriously bad or tragic happen to them. That if we do our part to be good Christians, God will do his part to shield us from the things in life that we fear the most. He'll allow some adversity into our lives because that helps us grow, but he'll keep us away from the really serious, bad, and tragic things. And if those tragic things come, then we might have to ask ourselves whether we really are the good Christians that we thought we were. All of which is complete nonsense. And Billings reminds us that God doesn't promise that bad things won't happen to us. I think it might be helpful to list some of the bad things that God doesn't promise to keep from us. God doesn't promise that we won't get a disease that kills us or debilitates us. He doesn't promise that we won't experience the loss of a spouse or a child. He doesn't promise that we won't ever lose our livelihood or struggle for work. He doesn't promise that we won't have serious relationship strife. He doesn't promise that we won't be attacked by the enemy. And he doesn't promise that we won't experience the evil of natural disasters. God doesn't promise any of that. But he promises to be with us and to see us through it all the way. He promises to be with us and to never forsake us and to bring us through to the end. Whatever harm befalls us in life will not be final harm. Whatever harm we experience in life will not be final harm. There's no spiritual law that says if I'm a good Christian, then God will spare me from the really bad things in life. We make that up. It's a fiction that we invent out of our anxiety about life and the fact that we live in a world that isn't safe. But in Jesus, God's faithfulness to us is beyond question. All we have to do is look at Jesus and know that God is with us and for us and will bring us through. God can't improve upon Jesus. God can't improve upon Jesus. He is good enough for us, and he has to be good enough for us, because God can't improve upon him. And in response, God calls us to live faithfully by his faithfulness. I think we're tempted to say a lot of the time, trust God and it will all work out. Trust God, it will all work out. But do things always work out? Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. I think if we were to go out to Habakkuk at his watch post and we were to say, Habakkuk, trust God, it'll all work out. I think Habakkuk would slowly shake his head and he would shorten that sentence for us and he would say, trust God, period. Trust God. That's what he would say. We live between the promises and their fulfillment. We live in the midst of the years. Trust God and don't base his faithfulness on a certain outcome. When there is trouble, and there will always be trouble, trust God, hold on, and keep holding on, no matter how bumpy the ride. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit beyond the vines. The produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food. The flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Amen. Amen.